We are at Psalm 99. Psalm 99 and 100 are the last of these five or six kingdom psalms, beginning at Psalm 95. All of them speaking of praise. You read the first lines in all of these psalms of blessing the Lord, of singing. Psalm 99 says, "The Lord reigneth." I love the ETH there. It means the Lord is presently reigning. Let the people tremble. The other psalm began, "The Lord reigneth." In verse 97, "Let the earth rejoice." This one is, "The Lord reigneth. Let the people tremble." Because both of those things are necessary because the Lord reigneth. "The Lord reigneth, let the people rejoice. The Lord reigneth, let the people tremble." Certainly the kingdom age will be a time when it says the knowledge of the Lord covers the earth like the waters cover the sea. Many remarkable descriptions of the kingdom age when the Lord takes up his throne in Jerusalem. But it is a time of trembling for those who would rebel also. Remember, as we go into the kingdom age, no doubt every human who makes that transition from the end of the tribulation into the kingdom age will be a believer. When the sun goes out and the moon refuses to shine, and the only thing that anyone can see in the skies is the Lord coming on a white horse with his vesture dipped in blood, when that's over, you're a believer. So those going into the kingdom age will be believers. But you have 1,000 years there where human beings will be born in their fallen state, and they will have to be born again. We look back to Christ on the cross and believe that he died for us, and in faith ask his forgiveness, God able then to both be just and the justifier of the ungodly. When we come willingly, repenting of our sin, turning away, turning to him in faith for forgiveness, he can cleanse and he can indwell us. During the kingdom age, people will have to look at this great king on the throne and believe that one day long ago, he was beaten and he was brutalized and he was spit upon. And by faith, in the same way, they'll have to accept that. So there will be those, even during the kingdom age, trembling will be more suitable for them because they're not willing to rejoice. So the Lord reigneth, let the people tremble. He sitteth between the cherubims, let the earth be moved. Cherubim, a form of angelic being. We're not certain. The seraphim are mentioned in Isaiah. They seem each to have six wings. With twain they fly, with twain they cover their feet, with twain they cover their heads. The cherubim seem to be of an angelic order. Four faces. Face of a man, face of an ox, face of an eagle, face of a lion. They're around the Lord's throne. You'll find them in Ezekiel 1, Ezekiel 10. They're not flying saucers, by the way. They're cherubim. It tells us right there, wheel within a wheel. You go through all of this stuff and you turn to chapter 10. It says these are the cherubim. So Von Donegan didn't read far enough. Angelic beings. Wonder when we read the description, Ezekiel trying to describe what he saw. And then we see them again in Revelation chapter 4, around the throne of God. Satan, it seems, was the anointed cherub. He was of that order in his unfallen state before he fell. So the cherubim there on the mercy seat, two of them with their wings touching over the mercy seat in the tabernacle, embroidered on the veil that separated the Holy of Holies from the holy place, no doubt a picture of those cherubim with a flaming sword that guarded the way to the tree of life in Eden after Adam fell. So the Lord, he is exalted. He sitteth between the cherubim. Let the earth be moved. The Lord is great in Zion. He is high above all people. Let them praise thy great and terrible name, for it is holy. And three times here we're going to have the refrain ending with holy, the idea of holiness mentioned three times. So his name is awesome, terrible, it is holy. It's set aside. There's only one name like that name. Now, his reign, the king's strength also, loveth judgment. Thou dost establish equity. Thou executest judgment and righteousness in Jacob. So a time when there will be equity, fairness, according to his estimation, righteousness. Exalt ye the Lord our God. Worship at his footstool. Here it is, for he is holy. Again, now, Moses and Aaron among his priests, and Samuel among them that call upon his name, they called upon the Lord, and he answered them. Moses, Aaron, and Samuel, interestingly. There's a place in Jeremiah where God says, though Samuel stood before me. So Samuel, not as much print as Moses, but certainly one of the most remarkable men in the Scripture as you study his life. Moses, Aaron, and Samuel, named here together as those who sought the Lord. They were intercessors. They besought the Lord on behalf of the people of Israel. Moses did, prayed, you know, said, Lord, spare them. If not, take me, strike my name. Aaron interceded for the people in their imperfection. And Samuel, we find, offering sacrifice and interceding for God's people in regards to their imperfection. So it seems to be in that sense, these three cried unto the Lord in regards to his people, and he heard them. He spake unto them in the cloudy pillar. They kept his testimonies and the ordinances that he gave them. These were obedient men. Not perfect, but their lives were characterized by obedience. You know, it's interesting when Moses fails and makes one mistake, and we know about Moses, one mistake. Don't you wish that when somebody wrote your personal history, it was that one mistake that was remarkable? Thou answerest them, O Lord our God. Thou wast a God that forgavest them, though thou tookest vengeance of their inventions. Now, it's a tough verse. Is it saying that God forgave them, though he took vengeance on their inventions? Is saying the people of Israel, God heard these men interceding for them and forgave the people of Israel, though God had to take measures with them because of their sin? Or is it saying, is it mentioning the fact of the failure of these three men, and yet God forgave them? We know that Aaron, when Moses went up onto the mount to receive the tables of stone in the presence of God, Aaron is pressured by the people. He's supposed to be the leader. He's going to be the first high priest. He's pressured by the people to make a golden calf. Moses comes down and says, what did you do? He said, they made me do it. He said, what are you talking about? He said, Moses, I'm as surprised as anybody. See, we got all their gold earrings and gold bracelets, threw them into the fire, and this calf jumped out. This is the first priest of the nation of Israel. He had to enter that priesthood knowing that he had to offer sacrifices for himself too, and understand that grace would be part of his ministry. Moses, of course, striking the rock. And God said to speak to it. It was a type of Christ. Paul says that rock that followed them was Christ. And Christ only need be smitten once. And he was smitten early in Exodus chapter 17. And Moses, angry at the people because they're complaining. It's an entire new generation. The generation that came out of Egypt have died off. The next generation learned to complain from their parents. They're experts. And they say, we were better off in Egypt. They were never in Egypt. Did you bring us out here to die? There's no water. Little chips off the old blocks. 2 million of them. And Moses, he's 120 years old, you know. He takes the rod of Aaron, and he's supposed to go and speak to the rock. He takes that rod and starts whacking that rock. And that rod had almonds and buds on it by then. You can see them flying everywhere. You rebels, he's screaming. And God says to him, Moses, you're not going to enter into the land because you failed to sanctify me in the hearts of the people. You failed to set me aside. Because now they think I'm just like you. They see the way you act and think that's the way I am. And I wasn't angry. And you touch this great type of the rock of ages, cleft for my people that need only be smitten once. And you flipped out, you spoke unadvisedly, you beat the rock up, you called them rebels, and now that's how they think I am. Now, isn't it interesting? The water came forth, the people drank. God doesn't punish his people for the wrong method of the leader. God forgave Moses, certainly, but he didn't enter into the land, not till the Mount of Transfiguration anyway. Samuel, I'm not sure. He had some failings. His sons didn't walk with the Lord, sadly. We don't have a specific. He's a remarkable man. Perhaps it's talking about the three. Regardless, the truth of God's forgiveness is there for the best and the worst of us, in a sense, for our highs and our lows. Thou forgavest them. You took vengeance on their inventions. You dealt with the sinful stuff they came up with. And I'm glad that God is faithful to do that. He busts me and he busts you. Because we're his kids, we don't get away with anything. You notice that after you get saved, you get busted all the time. Before you get saved, you should be able to get away with everything. Now, some people, when we were unbelievers, I had a cousin. And you never did anything wrong with him because he got caught no matter what he did. It was just, you know, Murphy's Law with this guy. So there are those people. My cousin, if he was going to do something, none of us did it with him. We didn't sneak around when we do anything wrong because he just got caught no matter what he did. But since we're saved, we can't get away with what unbelievers get away with. Because our Father loves us and he cares for us and he chastens us. So he dealt with their inventions. As children of God, if we compromise, if we backslide, we do something that is not in keeping with the Scripture, with the conviction of the Spirit, with the nature of God, with the nature of Christ that he's forming within us, God will deal with that. He'll forgive us, but take vengeance on our inventions, and sometimes that stings. Exalt the Lord, our God, and worship at his holy hill, for the Lord, our God, is holy. Again, it ends with that refrain that he is holy. Psalm 100. The pilgrims that came here called it the old 100th. It was one of their favorites, sung throughout church history, familiar to all of us. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands, literally all the earth. And it's kingdom singing, because this is over 500 years before the gospel goes to the Gentiles, and yet the song that's required is from all nations, from all the people of the earth. So, make a joyful noise unto the Lord, all ye lands. Serve the Lord with gladness. That's a great exhortation. Good bumper sticker. That's good plaque material. Serve the Lord with gladness. In fact, you could make a bumper sticker that said, serve the Lord with gladness, or don't. You know, because who wants somebody serving the Lord? I can't believe, here comes the offering bucket again. I can't believe they want me to be an usher. I can't believe I'm security. I can't believe I got to work in Sunday school with all these little rascals. I can't believe I got, you know, look, serve the Lord with gladness, or don't serve him at all, please. Serve the Lord with gladness. That's just good advice. What a privilege it is. You know, it's remarkable enough that we're saved. That he lets us touch the kingdom is really something. It's scarier than a father giving a 16-year-old the keys of the car. You know, what was the Lord saying when he said to Peter and those guys, I'm going to give you the keys of the kingdom? That would make me nervous. But he lets us serve him. Serve the Lord with gladness. Come before his presence with singing. Why? Because we should know that the Lord, he is God. It is he that hath made us. We have not evolved. Not we ourselves. We are his people and the sheep of his pasture. The first refrain. Now the second refrain. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving, into his courts with praise. Be thankful unto him and bless his name. Now, there are some who write those books, you know, like the seven steps of prayer. You have to do these seven things to get in the proper position. It's almost like yoga, prayer yoga or something, you know, to get in the right, you know, and the only way you really get close to him is you enter into his gates with thanksgiving, then you come into his courts with praise, then you have to be thankful, then you have to bless. The people write those things. I can't remember that many steps. I have four kids. None of them ever took more than one step to get in my presence. Hey, Dad, gimme. You know, I mean, what kind of a relationship is that? Dad, I'm on the fourth step. Wait a minute. I know you got to go. I'm working my way up here, you know. Our relationship with the Lord, prayer is the natural outflow of the new birth. It's the reason a baby says, Dada. And then ultimately, Dad. And then, can I have the keys to the car? These are things that will flow from us all as we step into his presence in the kingdom. We look into his face. We come to worship him. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving. Nobody's going to have to tell us to do that. Imagine what it will be like to go to Jerusalem when Jesus himself is on the throne. When $3 trillion of military spending is taken and designated to agricultural needs. When our swords and our spears are beaten into pruning hooks and plowshares. When peace covers the earth. When man learns war no more. No one's going to have to tell us. We're going to enter that way. We're going to come into his gates saying, ain't this awesome? And we'll still say ain't then, I think. Isn't this cool? I'm so thankful to be here. And into his courts with praise. Imagine coming into the gates of the city, then into the courts. Be thankful unto him and bless his name. For the Lord is good. His mercy is everlasting. And his truth endureth to all generations. Wow. I'm looking forward to it. I don't know about you guys. Psalm 101. Great psalm. This describes, it says, a psalm of David, probably written early. Probably before his sin with Bathsheba. We're not sure. But David, speaking of his private life and his public life, his role in his home, and then the role in the palace and in the city. And there's just some great stuff here. There's some great advice. I will sing of mercy and judgment. Unto thee, O Lord, will I sing. Private communion. Important for us, important, you know. And if your life is anything like mine, I know we're always running. We're always on the move. Always trying to find time. Isn't it funny? We're trying to find time and we already know where all the time is. 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day, 7 days in a week. We already know where all the time is and we're trying to find time. We have to make time, not find time. You know, there's some people who are just bums. They don't do anything. They got all the time in the world. They got the same time we have, and they just do something else with it. We spend our time. It's a gift that's given to us of God, and we do different things with it. But here, David, in the privacy of his own life, has communion with the Lord. He sings unto the Lord. And, you know, those early years out in the fields of Bethlehem, when no one was watching him, writing songs under the stars, when he fought with a lion and a bear and protected the flocks, he was out there with his guitar, writing songs, worshiping God, communion. Some, no doubt, something that remained with him his entire life. No doubt the thing that God saw and said, there's a man here that I want anointed with oil, a man after my own heart. It's that kid out in the field with the guitar. It stayed with him. I will sing of mercy and judgment unto thee, O Lord. I will sing. I will behave myself wisely in a perfect way. Now, this is not perfection the way we think of perfection. It is Same idea as unite my heart to fear thy name with consistency. There will be a oneness, a consistency about my way. I will behave myself wisely in a perfect way. Oh, when wilt thou come unto me? I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. He has determined and resolved to act wisely in his own house when no one's watching. That's what integrity is. It's what we do when no one's watching. It's what we do when no human eye is on us. It's what we do when we have temptation to sin and things are presented to us when nobody's around to look at us. And what we do then is integrity. And David's determined. I'm going to do what's right. I'm going to do this the right way. Lord, I'm going to behave myself in a wise way, in a mature way, in a complete way. When will you come unto me? I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. You know, one of the requirements for a leadership in the church is to have your house in order, because if you can't govern your own house, how will you govern the house of God? So David's saying here, in my private life, I'm going to have everything in order, and I'm going to do that with the right kind of heart. Safeguards. I will set no wicked thing before my eyes. Safeguard. I will set no wicked thing before my eyes. If you're online, get a filter. Get a Christian company that filters out the pornography. You can't keep up with it. There's too much of it. You'll open an email and something will be before your face before you know it. I will set no wicked thing before my eyes. You don't have to get HBO and movie channels these days to get something wicked in front of your eyes. You have to turn off the commercials in a football game or a basketball game these days. Guess a great plaque to put on the front of our television, huh? I will set no wicked thing before my eyes. I hate the work of them that turn aside. I hate what those people who are compromising are doing. David is committed to this. It shall not cleave unto me. I'm not going to let that kind of compromise infect my life. And it is infectious. Again, each one of us affect the others that are around us. I think years ago it was General Motors, or possibly it was Ford. I think it was General Motors. One of the large American corporations did a study and determined that the average human being in his lifetime, you dramatically affect the lives of between 150 and 200 people before you die. A significant effect. Now that's just the secular world coming to those kinds of conclusions. And as Christians, with a profession attached to our lives of what we believe and what we say God is and what we say God is like and what we say God requires and what we say He's doing in our lives, we affect people by what we do, by how we act. I will set no wicked thing before my eyes. I hate the work of those who turn aside. The idea is turning aside from the path of God. It shall not cleave to me. I don't want any of that stuff sticking to me. Cleave, you know, cleave here is like a husband shall cleave unto his wife. It's the same word used when God says that He is Jehovah Ra, I'm your healer, and none of the diseases that clung to the Egyptians shall cling to you. It speaks of being interwoven into our being. It says Job in his suffering that his tongue clove to the roof of his mouth was stuck. And the idea is none of this stuff will become part of my fabric. None of this stuff will stick to me. Good resolve. David will fail as his life goes on. But these are the kind of resolutions and determinations that we should have no trouble making, because they're clearly taught in Scripture. That stuff is not going to infect me. A froward, perverse heart shall depart from me. I will not know a wicked person. I'm not going to hang around with those who constantly live in sin. That's not what I'm going to do, and that's not how I'm going to live. A perverse heart, I don't want it around me. He says, I'm going to walk in my house with a perfect heart. in verse 2. Now he says here, I don't want a perverse heart around me. I don't want that kind of influence. That's the way I'm going to live my private life. I'm going to worship the Lord. I'm going to behave myself wisely. I'm going to walk in my house with the right kind of heart. I'm not going to put any wicked thing before my eyes. I hate the work of those that are turning aside and compromising from the path of God. I don't want it to become part of me. And a perverse heart, I'm going to push it away from me. I don't want to be around that. I'm not going to know, in the sense of, you know, camaraderie, a wicked person. In verse 5, he goes to his public life. And of course, the private life is necessary if the public life is to be everything that God wants it to be, whatever our field of service, wherever our sphere of influence is. We can't live like a hypocrite in private and have any kind of impact on the world around us publicly. And it'll never happen. Whoso secretly slandereth his neighbor, him will I cut off. Oh, it was easy for David. He was king. He could just cut somebody off. But you catch the drift of what he's saying. He's building his cabinet. He's building his court, his counselors. And he said, when I find those kind of people who secretly slander others, I'm going to put them out. I'm not going to have anything to do with them. Proverbs says this, cast out the scorner, and contention shall go out. Yea, strife and reproach shall cease. David is wise enough to realize, hey, I don't want this kind of guy in my inner circle who's constantly ripping into other people and tearing them down, is merciless with his mouth. Not going to be part of my team. Just wisdom. Him that hath a high look and a proud heart will I not suffer. I'm not going to let anybody in that's arrogant, that has that kind of trouble. He wants to walk in his house with a perfect heart, so he doesn't want a perverse heart or a proud heart around him. And, you know, pride was the center of Satan's fall. Pride wants to touch the glory, and we're never more like Satan, Billy Graham says, than when we touch the glory. Him that hath a high look and a proud heart will I not suffer. He doesn't want arrogant people as part of his cabinet. Again, wisdom. And you know what those people are like. You just think, you listen to them, and you think, man, this guy's stinking the whole place up. I can't wait till he gets out of here. You just know you don't want to be around them. Mine eyes shall be upon the faithful of the land. Surround yourself with faithful men. It's great advice. It's first required, Paul says, of a steward, that he be found faithful. Mine eyes shall be upon the faithful of the land, that they may dwell with me. He that walketh in a perfect way, he shall serve me. I'm looking for builders, not those who tear down. I'm looking for those who serve and build, those that are faithful. He that worketh deceit shall not dwell within my house. You know how you feel about someone who's deceitful or a liar. I mean, who wants to be around someone who... You know, let me $10. Give it to you next week. Swear to God, swear to God, swear to God. Give you $10. Give it to you next week. Swear to God, swear to God, swear to God. You know, if you're going to give it back to me, why do you got to swear to God 5 times? Just... He that worketh deceit shall not dwell within my house. He that telleth lies shall not tarry in my sight. I will early destroy all of the wicked of the land, that I may cut off all wicked doers from the city of the Lord. David wanted a clean house. His zeal is good. His determinations are good. The problem is, of course, as time went on, David found out he was one of them. As time went on, David, of course, committed adultery and murder. David had become jilted and hardened, desensitized. Great lessons, though. Certainly things to take to heart. wisdom, if you're building a company, building a business, building a ministry, of what you need to be in private and then who you want to add to your team in public. Just great stuff here. Psalm 102. A prayer of the afflicted when he is overwhelmed and poureth out his complaint before the Lord. So certainly it is that the first 11 verses are a prayer, crying out to the Lord. Verses 12 to 22 is not so much private but national, and a national cry. There's praise here, there's owning the Lord, certainly at least 12 to 15, at least there is a bright spot in this psalm. And then verses 23 to 28, we go back to the personal petition and prayer again in this song, this person who is crying out. Most people who examine it feel that it was written in light of the Babylonian captivity, and it contains an exhortation to return to the land, to return to Jerusalem. Possibly prophetic in that respect, possibly written after the door was literally open to do that. We're not certain of the author or the timing. But we are certain of the cry of this writer's heart, because we've cried these things in our own hearts. Hear my prayer, O Lord, and let my cry come unto thee. Hide not thy face from me in the day when I am in trouble. Incline thine ear unto me in the day when I call. Answer me speedily. Lord, when I'm in a pickle, I expect you to be right there. When I cry unto you, answer me speedily. Now, the question is this give and take here? When the Lord cries unto us, do we answer him speedily? Do we give what we're asking for? When he says to us, no, don't touch that, put that down. Do we say, okay, you're right? Or do we say, you know, Lord, this really doesn't stumble me. There are weaker Christians out there that you need to worry about, and I'm mature, I'm fine, and I just want you to know that you can worry about the rest of them. I'll be fine today here. And the Lord is so relieved to hear that from us. When he speaks to us, how speedily do we respond? You know, this is what the psalmist wants. Lord, I'm in trouble. I've got in this jam. I'm in pain. My heart is crying. Whatever brought about the circumstances, we're not told, but now crying to the Lord. And if you're anything like me, you know, and when things are going good, I pray things are going good prayers. Hey, Lord. Great day, huh? Thanks. What a blessing. See you at lunch. Talk to you before I go to bed. What a great day. And when things are desperate, I pray desperate prayers. Where are you, Lord? I need you. Answer me speedily. Do we give the same response? How promptly do I? I'll examine my own heart as I read this. How promptly do I respond to the Spirit and his conviction, his direction, his word? Answer me when I call speedily, for my days are consumed like smoke. Everything's gone up in smoke, Lord. My bones are burned as the earth. I'm dried up. I am worn out. My heart is smitten, withered like grass. And here's how bad it is, so that I forget to eat my food. This is the crisis diet. He is in such a serious situation that he's lost his appetite. That should tell us how bad things are here in this circumstance. Lord, I'm withered. I'm dried up. I'm shot. I'm tired. My bones are burned up. I'm withered like grass, so that I don't even have my appetite. Lord, I've lost my appetite. By reason of the voice of my groaning, my bones cleave to my skin. Is there a physical illness here? I'm not sure. Certainly there is a level of suffering to one degree or another. Then he says, I am like a pelican of the wilderness. You can all relate to that. You know how those pelicans are in the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. I watch and am like a sparrow alone on the house. So what he's trying to say with all three of these members of the bird world is their solitariness. I am like a pelican of the wilderness. I am like an owl of the desert. I watch. I'm like a sparrow alone, which is unusual to see a sparrow. I'm like a sparrow alone on the housetop. Lord, not only am I struggling physically with something that has caused me to lose my appetite, I'm crying out to you. I feel so isolated. I feel so solitary. Now, there is a sanctified loneliness. There is a place that God puts us in when He wants us alone. And when He wants us alone, He doesn't have to take us away from the crowd. You can sit here in a room full of people and feel completely alone. You can go to your relative's house at a Christmas dinner, Christmas party, and there's all this noise and everybody, and you can stand there and feel completely alone. Like there is no one here that can relate to me. There is nobody here. I am completely alone. And he says that is part of what is taking place in all of this. Like a pelican in the wilderness, like an owl in the desert, like a sparrow, like a little sparrow sitting alone on the housetop. Besides that, there are enemies now. This is a blues song, no doubt. Mine enemies, B.B. King could sing this. Mine enemies reproach me all the day. They that are mad against me are sworn against me. For I have eaten ashes like bread. Now this is all the way down. And mingled my drink with weeping. I have eaten ashes, probably. Girt dressed himself in sackcloth and ashes, mourning, seeking God, because of thine indignation and thy wrath. Now, the interesting thing is, in the process here, he is owning this desperate time and saying, Lord, it is under your sovereignty and your providence. Lord, I am going through these things because of your indignation. The reason that I'm crying out and I'm broken inside and I'm just shot. I'm worn out. I feel like I can't go on. I don't even have an appetite. Is because of you, Lord. The reason that I feel so lonely and solitary and isolated is something you've done, Lord. The reason that there are enemies that have risen up against me, Lord, is something that you've done. I'm not bitter at the circumstances. I'm not bitter at the people. You know, this singer has turned his heart to God and said, Lord, I realize there's a divine plan in all of this. Because of thine indignation and thy wrath, for thou hast lifted me up and you have cast me down. I feel like a yo-yo, Lord. I'm up and down, up and down. You've lifted me up and you've let me fall. You've let me down. Not he's let us down in the sense that he lets us down, but the point is the highs and the lows of his experience he's owning as under the divine hand of God's sovereignty. My days are like a shadow that declines. We have that today, running out of time, like the shadow on the sundial going down. He sees his life running out. And I am withered like grass. Well, these first 11 verses, this song of ancient Israel, this songwriter speaking of difficulty. That's why this title, The Prayer of the Afflicted, when he is overwhelmed and he's pouring out his complaint before the Lord. Now, the tone of it changes at verse 12, and we have more a national cry, it seems. But thou, O Lord, shall endure forever. Lord, in contrast to me and these things I'm going through, Lord, you never change. You'll endure forever. And thy remembrance unto all generations. How wonderful that God never changes. Thou shalt arise and have mercy upon Zion. for the time to favor her, yea, the set time is come. Now that's remarkable. It's not just, Lord, under your sovereignty, Lord, the set time is come. Lord, you have times and seasons set within your own power, possibly knowing about Jeremiah's prophecy, possibly knowing there were 70 years determined upon Jerusalem. We're not sure of that. But in all of this difficulty, this person is able to say, Lord, the set time has come. There are boundaries on time, not just running wild without your control. There is a set time. And possibly, Lord, this is the time of restoration. We're living in a day when we can say, Lord, the set time has come. We see Jerusalem, the stumbling block of all the nations of the world. That's what the prophet said we would see. Jerusalem, a cup of trembling. Negotiators, politicians, power brokers, no one knowing what to do with this city and this land that's stumbling the world. That's just where the prophet said we'd be. The set time has come. That's where we are. And we're told when we see these things, we should lift up our heads. We know our redemption is drawn nigh. So the set time, this psalmist owns here. For thy servants take pleasure in her stones and favor the dust thereof. Lord, take pleasure in her stones. You know, those of you who had made the trip to Israel with us, and I doubt whether we're going to do that again unless it calms down. We've been there, I think, 13 or 14 times, but when we look on the news and see the places that we normally sit in blowing up, we're not going there right now. And we should pray for the Palestinian people as well as the Israelis. I mean, it's a difficult situation. And it's man's inability to govern himself. And things ultimately won't change till the Prince of Peace comes. But the Israeli guides love to tell you about the stones. And it is a rocky place. And when you come up to Jerusalem, there's stones laying everywhere. And they tell these traditional tales about pilgrims through the centuries who came, and the stones represent all of the burdens that they dropped off as they ascended the hill to Jerusalem to worship the Lord. And surrounded, it's a stony place. American tourists take many of them back to the United States. We weigh more and more back here every time we bring back a busload from Israel. Your suitcases are way heavier on the way back than they are on the way over. Because you get all these stones for free and they make great paperweights. You have to pay for them and you give them out. And one time I came back, had to bring 22 stones for one of my kids' elementary school classes from the Valley of Elah, from the brook there where David took the 5 stones. So they were telling the whole class the story. So I had to bring back, my suitcase weighed too much. You know, and the Israeli guide opens the airport security, looks in there, tourist, huh? Your old suitcase is full of rocks. For thy servants take pleasure in her stones and favor the dust thereof. So the heathen shall fear the name of the Lord, and all the kings of the earth thy glory. And this is a remarkable verse. When the Lord shall build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory. When the Lord shall build up Zion. I mean, interesting to watch what's going on over in that part of the world now. How this land abandoned for 2,000 years, the people back in the land. Jerusalem in the center of the news again. I mean, a nation reborn. You know, the Seneca Indians have been out of Manhattan for 300 years. Just think how preposterous it would be for them to come back and say, here are the beads, we changed our mind, give us back Manhattan. It was a bad trade. And we want to be members of the UN, too. You know, that seems preposterous to us. What about people that are gone for 2,000 years and then reborn as a nation again? A sociological miracle. And now Israel, swampy when they got there, malaria everywhere. People that had been lawyers and doctors and jewelers having to learn to farm and to irrigate, and a remarkable tale. To where now, as Isaiah and Ezekiel say, the fruit of Israel fills the earth, the Jordan Valley producing more per acre than any other piece of land on the face of the earth. Plane loads every day of flowers and fresh fruit and vegetables flown throughout Europe. Remarkable to see what's happened there. the immigration, the cities being rebuilt, the old waste places being restored. And it says, when the Lord shall build up Zion, he shall appear in his glory. Well, it's getting close, isn't it? He will regard the prayer of the destitute and not despise their prayer. This shall be written for the generation to come. And here we are. And the people which shall be created shall praise the Lord. I think that's speaking about us and the Gentiles being gathered in. A people shall there come, a people which shall be created. For he hath looked down from the height of his sanctuary. From heaven did the Lord behold the earth, to hear the groaning of the prisoner, to loose those that were appointed to death. Certainly that's what he did in our lives. I don't know about you, but the Lord heard my groaning. I had my act together. I lived a certain way and spent time with my peers who listened to the same things and smoked the same things and snorted the same things and acted the same way and dressed the same way. And you found whatever consolation you found in that camaraderie, however broken and empty it was. But the Lord looked down and had pity on my generation. I believe on the generation that we see today also. He hears our groaning, the groaning of the prisoner. Certainly that was me. To loose those that are appointed to death. Certainly that was me, and I'm sure you can relate to that. Declare the name of the Lord in Zion, and his praise in Jerusalem. When the people are gathered together, and the kingdoms, plural, to serve the Lord. What a remarkable day that's going to be again. Everyone headed there. You know, we'll sit there. We'll say, remember that night? Calvary? When everybody was home watching football, and we came to church, and we studied the 102nd Psalm, and said that we'd come and sit here with the nations as they come. Here we are. When the people are gathered together and the kingdom serve the Lord. 23 now, this prayer seems to kick back in at this point in time. He weakened my strength in the way, or afflicted my strength in the way. Again, he seems to be owning the fact that God dealt with him in the path of his life. And it's back to the personal prayer again. He afflicted my strength in the way. God put his finger on me. He shortened my days. Now, they're short enough. He shortened my days. How many of them do we have left? And how are we spending them? Again, saved since 1972. That's just over 11,000 days at this point in time. How do we spend them? It's a more precious commodity than money, than anything else we have. How are we spending time that's given to us? How do we spend it? How do we use it? What do we use it for? And look, an exhortation to my own heart. He shortened my days. I said, oh my God, take me not away in the midst of my days. Lord, don't cut me off, Lord, in the middle of this, Lord. And whatever, there's no doubt there's something here going on between the psalmist and God that we don't have all the details of. Is he middle-aged here? Is he saying, just don't cut me off in my youth, Lord? Don't cut me off in the middle of my days. Thy years are throughout all generations. Lord, time means nothing to you. You're eternal. You're throughout all generations, Lord. I'm so temporary. Don't cut me off in the middle of my days. Of old hast thou laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. Not the Big Bang. The heavens are the work of thy hands. You know, because if you... And the truth is, well, do we even want to go there? You know, even Stephen Hawking, even some of the brilliant people, the astrophysicists, I mean, you know, they struggle with this whole, like, you know, they come up with something, you know, the Big Bang, that everything that existed at one point was the size of a softball, and the density of it was so tremendous, and it was so heavy, you know, that the atomic structure of the whole entire universe that we see today was compressed into this ball of density, and because of the density of it, it exploded, and it exploded, and it shot out. And that's where our universe has come from, and it's spreading out, and at some point it will reach its ultimate spreading out point. That's probably not the scientific term. It will get out there to where it ain't spreading out no more, and gravity will start to pull it back again, and it will start to collapse, and it will come back again. Everything will get sucked, you know, because, you know, they're looking at black holes now. And as they look at black holes, they realize that light is being sucked into a black hole. Now, the thing that they don't want to talk about is that means time is matter, because it's relative to light, and that's being sucked into a black hole. And the thing that they all lie about is now they know that light, 186,000 miles per second, is not a constant, and you can't quantify the universe, because light gets sucked into a black hole, which means it travels across the universe. It doesn't have a constant speed, because when it gets around that great of a magnetic pull, it bends, and sometimes it even disappears. So 186,000 miles a second is not a constant speed of light. But we can't talk about that, because all the scientists will jump out the window if we do that. So anyhow, they believe, you know, that it all spreads out like that, and then it starts to get sucked back in again, and it'll all come back in again. It'll come in with such tremendous force and tremendous force, then it'll come back to the middle again, and it'll all squeeze down to a softball again, and that'll be so much pressure and so much power compressed in such a small thing that it'll explode and it'll go out again. So we have creation cycles, and as it goes out, and billions of years go by, and moisture develops on a planet at the right distance from a sun, lightning will strike the pond scum, and your great-great-great-great-grandma will climb out with a tail and develop an eye on the top of her head from a freckle. And, you know, this is so much simpler. Of old, thou hast laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. Takes way less faith to believe that than it does to believe what they've come up with. What they've come up with is preposterous. Yeah, we could stay there for a while, couldn't we? All I know is David said, thou hast made us a little lower than the angels. And it's much better to be a little lower than the angels than a little higher than the monkeys. But as it is, as your faith is, so be it unto you. They shall perish, the heavens, but thou shalt endure. Yea, all of them shall wax old like a garment. Entropy. The second law of thermodynamics. Embraced by every scientist. Makes evolution impossible. Because we're going from the complex to the simple. Things are breaking down. Problem is, takes about 200 bits of information to run the entire universe. It's all hydrogen, helium, gases. Takes over 1 billion bits of information to run a simple cell, and it takes over 1 trillion bits of information to run you. So you can't evolve from the simple to the complex because of the second law of thermodynamics. You could only evolve from the complex to the simple, which is de-evolving. So there is no such thing as evolving, only de-evolving. That's probably not even a scientific word. The scripture knows that this is all winding down like an old clock. It's running out of gas, the whole universe. They shall all perish, the heavens, but thou shalt endure. Yea, all of them shall wax old like a garment. As a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. But thou art the same. God is immutable. He never changes. Isn't it wonderful to relate to somebody that never changes? What we love about him is what the unbeliever hates about him. We love that He is immutable. He never changes. The unbeliever hates that. For every 4 years, we elected a new God, they could put up with Him for 4 years. But because He never changes, sin is always sin. Human weakness is always human weakness. God's holiness is always God's holiness. And I'm thankful He never changes, because the promises He made to us are yea and amen. He's never going to say, you know, when I said that, I never thought you would take me up on it. When I said whosoever will, I didn't think you'd be part of the whosoever. No. Thou art the same. He's immutable. Thy years have no end. He is eternal. And the children of thy servants shall continue. And their seed shall be established before thee. The children of thy servants shall continue. Some of that falls on us, doesn't it? John, in his second epistle, said, I have no greater joy than to know my children walk in truth. Children of thy servants shall abide forever. Passing the baton to the next generation. You know, last time K.P. Hannon was here, you know, and he started 3,000 churches in the 1040 window in the last 15, 20 years. He has 6,000 students in Bible college right now. They baptized 15,000 people last month. And as we talked, you know, I said, you know, and all of the things that the Lord has done, you know, what is your greatest sense of accomplishment? He said, that's easy. Both my kids are walking with the Lord. And so we're all four of mine right now. You hope that keeps up, because you know they change course sometimes. The generation of those that serve thee, their seed shall be prolonged.